to go unchecked for so long. Faith flipped to Delilah's next arrest. More oxy sales at age 12, and then again at 15. By 16, Delilah had dropped out of school and was slinging heroin, which was what happened when you couldn't afford oxy anymore. A single 80-milligram pill could run $60 to $100, depending on the market. The same money for a bag of heroin could keep you high for days. She flipped ahead to the charging sheets. Parole, diversion treatment, more parole, rehab. Despite her criminal history, Delilah Palmer had never spent more than a night in jail. Her first prostitution arrest came at the end of her 16th year. There were four more arrests for solicitation, two more for selling pot and heroin, respectively, all accompanied by a free one-night accommodation in the Fulton County Jail. Faith scanned the names of the arresting officers. Some of them were familiar. Most of them were from Zone 6, which made sense, because criminals were like everybody else. They tended to stay in their own neighborhoods. Dale Harding had also worked in Zone 6. He had obviously kept an eye on Delilah Palmer for most of her life. Reading between the lines, Faith guessed that he'd called in every favor he had to keep the girl from doing serious time. Collier said, "You gonna share or do I have to guess?" "You smell like vomit." "I just threw up. Didn't you hear me in the bathroom? It, like, echoed." She handed him Delilah Palmer's rap sheet. "Two bedrooms, two beds. Someone was staying here with Harding." "You think it was this Palmer chick?" He frowned. "She ain't much, but she could do better than Harding." Faith thought about the locked closet, the bucket, the sewage smell. Harding could have been doing his own rehab. Cold turkey in a closet was a hell of a lot cheaper than 15 grand for inpatient treatment. Again. That might better explain the squalor. This place certainly looked like a junkie was living here. "Did you see over there?" Collier nodded toward a retainer on the floor. "My sisters all wore those after they got their braces off. Like, not the same retainer, different ones, but they were all small, just like that one. Meaning it sized like what a girl would wear in her mouth." Faith couldn't understand why he used so many words to say just one thing. "What about the website?" "Nothing popped out," he laughed. "Pun intended. I'm more of a front door man myself, especially the knockers." Faith felt the strain of her eyes rolling. "You know what, Mitchell? When I first met you, I figured we'd end up in a bedroom looking at porn." Faith started to stand. "Hold on." He grabbed a stack of photographs from the box. "Look at these. Delilah's been modeling for a while, the backdoorman.com ones. I'd say they started when she was around 16. The earlier ones don't have a website or identifying marks, but I'd put her closer to 12, maybe 13. Faith put the photos side by side with the mugshots from Delilah's various arrests. Collier's estimate was off by a few years. Faith could pin down the age back to the girl's first arrest at 10 years old. The illicit image was heartbreaking. Delilah was dressed in lace panties and a bra that must have been clipped in the back so it wouldn't slide down to her feet. She didn't have a waist yet, or curves, or anything but baby fat that the heroin would eventually wear away. Faith looked at her dull, lifeless eyes. Everything about the girl reeked of abandon. Why was Harding, who by all accounts didn't give a shit about anyone or anything, so interested in this abandoned girl? What did she mean to him? Collier asked,
"What's next, Kemosabe?"
"I'll be right back." Faith stood up. She went back into the kitchen. Again, Collier followed her. He was like a kid, always underfoot. She longed for Will's quiet self-containment.
"We can be apart for longer than 2 seconds." "Then how will I know what you're up to?"
She opened the freezer door. Ice cream and alcohol filled the shelves, but there was also a quart-sized Ziploc bag with a stack of papers shoved into the back. Freezer burn had melded it to a box of fish fingers. Faith had to hit the box on the side of the fridge to break away the bag. People with chronic or end-stage diseases
were told to leave valuable documents like medical directives in their freezer so that paramedics could easily find them. As horrible a man as Harding was, he had managed to follow the guideline. Except his directive explicitly stated that all possible measures should be taken to preserve his life. Jesus, Collier said, because of course he was reading over Faith's shoulder. The guy's got a death warrant, but he wants the paramedics to keep him alive for as long as possible? This was filled out 2 years ago. Maybe he forgot about it. Faith found the contact information on the second page. Next of kin, Delilah Jean Palmer. Relationship, daughter. She was his kid, Collier said, because he had forgotten that Faith had eyes in her head. Her juvie rap sheet listed her as an orphan. There were three phone numbers beside Delilah's name, two of which had lines drawn through them. All of them were in different shades of ink. Faith used Harding's landline and dialed the most recent number. It went straight into a pre-recorded message from the phone company informing Faith that the number had been disconnected. She tried the other two numbers just to be sure. Disconnected. Collier took out his cell phone. My turn to work some magic? Help yourself. Collier started to follow her back to the bedroom, but she put her hand out to stop him. We don't have to do everything together. What if the rat comes back? With its babies. Scream really loud. She headed down the hallway again, glancing up the attic stairs because the rat was still up there, possibly giving birth to triplets, because that was the kind of day she was having. Thank God Faith had made more holes in the ceiling in case the thing decided it wanted to expand its territory. She sat down in the chair and made herself look at the photos of Delilah again. Putting aside how disgusting it was that a father kept pictures of his naked daughter, age 12, bending over a stick riding horse, there was something off about the girl. Faith couldn't articulate what made the photos different from the hundreds of similar photos she had seen throughout her law enforcement career, but it was there. Exploitation had a common theme, misery. Delilah's eyes were glassy, likely from the heroin that had either been given or withheld so that she would pose for the camera. Her thighs were red where someone had been rough with her. A thin powdering of makeup barely concealed the bruising around her neck. There was lipstick on her teeth. None of this was new or particularly surprising. It was the same feeling Faith had been having all day. Something wasn't adding up. Faith hated when things didn't add up.
It's weird that they're pictures, right?
Collier was hovering in the doorway again. Faith said, You mean like some fathers keep school pictures of their kids, only Harding kept naked photos?
No, I mean, why doesn't he have videos? Porn is the sole reason for the internet. It ruined the nudie pic industry. Even Playboy gave up the ghost.
You're asking why Harding was looking at naked pictures of his daughter instead of naked videos?
Basically. Shit.
He clapped his hand to his throat. He coughed.
I think I swallowed a fly.
Try keeping your mouth shut.
Ha ha.
He sat down on the mattress again. It made the sound again. He gave her the look. Again.
I asked my girl in records to run a priority background on little Delilah. We'll see what she's been up to lately. With Harding dead, she'll wind up in jail soon, and there won't be anybody to get her out.
She could know something, Faith said. We have to figure out what Harding was up to over the last week or so of his life. That's going to tell us why he ended up in Rippy's nightclub. She tried to talk through what was bothering her. Was he a pedophile or a bad father?
My vote goes for both.
He must have broken his piggy bank over this chick. A cop's currency was knowing who to call, and also knowing that when that person called you back, you did what they wanted, no questions asked. This isn't asking a uni to lose a speeding ticket. These are high-level favors. Lieutenants and parole officers and judges, even. No way he could pay all of that back. He worked white-collar. He didn't have the juice. There was probably nobody left on the force who would answer his calls.
You know the story about the dad who stopped going to work. He He couldn't leave his little girls behind. Faith shook her head, wishing Collier would shut the hell up. Will's sense of humor could be irreverent, but he would never, ever joke about a man molesting his own child. Miraculously, Collier finally picked up on her mood.
Harding doesn't have a computer or a printer.
Faith checked the paper stock on the photos. These weren't printed at a lab. Somebody did them privately.
You think someone printed them out for him?
For what? Blackmail? She thought about Harding's windfall 6 months ago. He moved into the Mesa Arms. He bought a new car. It would be the other way around. Harding's the one who came into some scratch. I have a good mind to call the lottery board and run his name. Collier's phone buzzed. His finger slid across the screen. Attachment. He waited for the download.
Oh, man, this keeps getting better and better.
He held up the phone. The screen showed a scan of an official marriage license. Faith squinted at the words. She had to read them twice before their meaning came through. 5.5 months ago, Vernon Dale Harding had married Delilah Jean Palmer. It was his 5th marriage, and her 1st. Faith put her hand to her mouth, then thought better of it.
Damn, Collier said. Dude married his own daughter.
That can't be right.
You can see it right here, processed and everything.
He listed her as his daughter 2 years ago. You saw it on the forms. Collier didn't seem as confused as she felt.
The DNR forms aren't official, at least not unless somebody finds them and takes them to the hospital.
Faith felt her head shaking in confusion. She wanted to go back and look at the papers again, but she knew she hadn't read them wrong. How did that even happen? You can't marry somebody you're related to. You have to fill out a license. They run the...
She was always an orphan in the system. Harding probably never had parental rights. They could do all the background checks they wanted and the relationship wouldn't show up.
Faith had let the pornographic photos fall out of her hands. She looked down at the scattered images and tried not to think about why Dale Harding had kept them over the years. Good God, this poor girl never had a chance.
He wasn't sleeping with her. Collier stopped Faith's protest. Not recently, at least. There's no Viagra in the bathroom, and considering what that guy had going on, there was no farmer left in the Dale.
He laughed.
Like, the tractor wasn't up to plowing the fields?
We need to find this girl. Faith started typing a text to Amanda to put out an APB. She's Harding's legal wife. Harding was found dead or murdered in a room full of blood. If I'm his killer, then I'm looking for anyone Harding might have confided in. Whether she's his wife or daughter, she has to know something, just by virtue of the fact that she was living with him.
Did you notice she's not here?
Collier's mood had shifted. He was getting it now.
The TV's gone. There's no computer. Maybe she heard that he was dead, knew that there was a target on her back, so she sold his shit and got out of Dodge.
Violet, the property manager, never met Delilah. There's the weird closet thing. Why would you keep a girl hidden away from everybody in the neighborhood unless there was a reason to keep her hidden? Collier said,
She's a whore, so she knows the streets. She was probably working Harding the same as he was working her. Maybe she's the one who got him killed. I can see that happening. Girl crosses the wrong guy, Harding swoops in to protect her, and gets a doorknob for his troubles.
Either way, she's in danger, Faith asked. Did records give you her last known address? Collier went back to his phone.
Renaissance Suites off I-20. My girl already called the manager, texted him a photo from Delilah's last booking. He says he don't know nothing about nothing.
Faith heard her phone chirp. She read the text.
Amanda's put out the APB on Delilah.
You need to work your back channels in the APD for information on the girl. Knock on every door to every building or house she's ever lived in. Check into her juvie record, go by her school, whatever it takes to find out who her friends were. Collier had a weird look on his face.
Anything else, boss lady?
Yeah, she was busted for soliciting, so she'll have a pimp. Find him, talk to him, run him in if you have to.
The alarm went off on Faith's phone. She started shoving the files and photographs back into the boxes.
We need to find Delilah before someone else does.
Collier asked,
What are you going to be doing while I pound out this awesome amount of shoe leather?
I've got to go to the hospital and talk to the Jane Doe that Will found. She might have seen something last night.
Technically, we found her, as in Will and me.
Will and I. She muscled up the boxes. They were heavier than she'd anticipated. I should have Harding's banking and phone information by the time I get to Grady. I'll go through these files and cross-check them against...
Wait. Collier was trailing her down the hall. Again. You're Jane Doe. She knows me. She'd be more likely to talk to a friendly face.
Faith stopped. Collier bumped into her from behind. She told him, Charlie Reed, our crime scene guy, will be here any minute. Wait for him, then go look for Delilah. If she's out there, we need to talk to her. If Angie and Harding were killed for a reason, she might know the reason. And that reason could get her killed, too.
You really think she's in danger?
Don't you?
You're not much of a feminist, are you?
Collier grinned at what must have been the shocked look on her face.
Could be Delilah's the one that went after both of them. Angie and Harding? Ever think of that? Women are capable of murder, too, partner.
If you call me partner again, you'll find out exactly what women are capable of. For once, Collier took her seriously.
I'll get Ying started. Join him as soon as your guy gets here. Should I call you later?
If you find Delilah or have valuable information, yes.
What if I want to look at some more porn with you?
Faith shouldered open the front door. She kept her head down so her retinas wouldn't ignite. At her car, she balanced the boxes on one knee and fumbled with the door handle until she nearly dropped everything. She finally managed to yank back the handle with the tip of her pinky finger. She used the toe of her shoe to pry open the door. She threw the boxes into the passenger seat. She got behind the wheel, all the while Collier stood in the open front doorway, not bothering to offer any help whatsoever. He was up her ass when she didn't need him, and she couldn't get him to move a muscle when she did.
God damn it, Faith muttered.
Amanda was right. He was exactly her type. Chapter 5 Will stood in the lobby of the gleaming Tower Place 100 office building. The 29-story skyscraper was part of the Tower Place complex, which anchored the corner of Piedmont and Peachtree Road and was only partially responsible for the dense line of Jaguars and Maseratis that clogged Buckhead morning, noon, and night. He hadn't planned on being here so much as followed the breadcrumbs Angie had left. First, he'd gone home to change and get some documents from his safe. Then he'd gone to Angie's bank, which led to the store where she kept her post office box, which led him to this office building, where he stuck out like a country rube because he'd foregone his usual suit and tie for something more comfortable. He couldn't even pass for a tech billionaire. His jeans were lucky, not Armani. Sarah had bought his long-sleeve polo from a store he had never heard of. His old running sneakers were splotched with the French blue paint from his bathroom. He had painted the walls a lighter color because he had realized one morning that the chocolates and dark browns he had chosen for his house were too masculine for Sarah.
Sarah.
Will felt his chest rise and fall with a deep, calming breath. Just the thought of her name had drained away some of his anxiety. He allowed himself a moment to remember how good it felt to wake up in the middle of the night and find Sarah's body draped across his. She fit him like the last piece of a complicated puzzle. He had never met anyone like her before. She woke him up sometimes just to be with him, her hands on him, wanting him. Angie had never wanted him like that. So why was he here? Will looked down at the thick, gray envelope in his hands. The multicolored logo for Kip Kilpatrick's management company was in the corner. Angie's name was typed above a P.O. box number. The box was located in a Midtown UPS store. There were actually
two envelopes inside the box, but the one with the colored logo was the one Will saw first, and his heart had stopped like a train smashing into a brick wall. He had stood motionless in the UPS store, staring at the envelope, not touching it, trying to get over his shock. Here was a concrete link between Angie and Kip Kilpatrick and, by extension, Marcus Rippey. He should have called Amanda immediately, gotten a forensic team for fingerprints and to run the security footage. But Will hadn't done any of this, because, among other things, Amanda would want to know how he had tracked down the post office box number in the first place. Angie's bank had given Will copies of her statements showing her mailing address. He'd offered the manager his marriage certificate to prove that he was still legally married to Angie. The woman hadn't needed to see it. All she'd needed was his driver's license. Will's name was still on Angie's checking account, the same as it had been for the last 20 years. He had not told Sarah about the account. Angie's recent bank statement had shown an unusually large balance. She had always lived paycheck to paycheck. Will was the saver, the one who was terrified of running out of money and living on the streets again. Angie spent money as soon as it was in her pocket. She had told Will that she was going to die young, so she might as well have fun. Had she died young? Was 43 middle-aged anymore? The 2 to 3 hour window to find Angie alive had closed hours ago. Sarah was a good doctor. She knew how to read a crime scene, and she knew how much blood was supposed to be inside of a body. Still, Will could not accept that Angie was dead. He wasn't one for cosmic signs, but he knew that if something really bad happened to her, he would feel it in his gut. Will folded the envelope in half, then shoved it into his back pocket as he headed toward the bank of elevators. He passed on 2 cars before realizing there was no way he would find one that wasn't already packed with people from the parking deck. He looked at his watch. At 3:30 in the afternoon, the office worker should be pushing the clock to go home, not returning from late lunches. The elevator he finally jammed himself into was filled with the lingering odor of alcohol and cigarettes. Buttons were pressed. Will looked at the panel. They were going to stop on almost every floor. He had been to Kip Kilpatrick's office only once, during the brief and uneventful interview with Marcus Rippey. Will could still recall the opulent details inside the offices because it was the sort of place specifically designed to stick in your head. 110 Sports Management took up the top 2 floors of the building, seemingly so that they could build a fancy floating glass staircase connecting the 2 levels. There were life-size fathead stickers all over the walls showing players dunking basketballs, rushing the net, and throwing game-winning touchdowns. Framed jerseys with familiar numbers were in a straight line outside the conference room like photos of past CEOs, which was appropriate because sports was a billion-dollar business. Godlike athleticism wasn't enough to pay the bills. You had to have lifestyle brands and sneaker endorsements and your own clothing line to prove that you'd really made it. Behind all of those billion-dollar deals, you also had to have a team of lawyers and managers and agents and brokers who all got their cut. Which was great, but it also created problems. Coca-Cola was a billion-dollar industry too, but there were lots of cans of Coke and bottlers who could make more of it. If a can of Coke exploded, you could get another one out of the fridge. If an athlete got pulled over going 100 miles an hour down I-75 while snorting cocaine with a hooker in his lap, then your entire business was dead the second TMZ posted the mugshot. There was only one Serena Williams. There was only one Peyton Manning. There was only one Marcus Rippey. Will forced out the image that came to mind when he thought of Marcus Rippey. Not the many photos of the athlete standing by his $300,000 car, or on board his private Gulfstream, or with his hand resting on the massive head of his purebred Alaskan husky. The one of him at home with his family, acting like a happy father and caring husband, while Keisha Miscavige, the woman Rippey had brutally raped, had around-the-clock protection because of the death threats from his fans. One word from the ballplayer could stop those guys. One line in an interview or post to his Twitter account would make it possible for Keisha Miscavige to go home and start putting her life back together. Then again, Rippy probably got a kick out of knowing she was still imprisoned. A bell dinged. Fifth floor, the elevator doors opened. A handful of people got off. Will stood with his back pressed against the wall. He put his hand to his neck, remembering a second too late that he wasn't wearing a tie. After Collier had dropped him at the house, Will had assumed he was on some sort of leave, if not outright fired. He remembered thinking that men who were unemployed did not have to wear a suit and tie. It was kind of the point of being unemployed. Now he regretted his clothing choices. But when he set off from his house a few hours ago, he'd assumed he was going to be chasing down leads on Angie, not confronting Kit Kilpatrick. The elevator stopped at the 12th floor. Half of the people got off. No one else got on. Will kept his back to the wall. The car stopped two more floors up. One person got on and took the ride to the next floor. By the time the car left the 15th floor, Will was finally alone. He watched the display flash as the elevator took an ear-popping ascent toward the top floor. Each time the number changed, he thought, Angie, Angie, Angie. Was he deluding himself? Was she really dead? Will had made his share of death notifications, steeling himself before knocking on a door, offering a shoulder to lean on or a face to scream at when he told a mother, father, husband, wife, child, that their loved one would never come home again. What was it like to be on the other side? Would Will get a call in an hour or a day or a week? Would he be told that a patrol car had rolled up on Angie's Monte Carlo and found her lifeless body slumped over the wheel? Will would have to identify her. He would need to see her face before he believed that she was gone. In the unrelenting summer heat, what would she look like after all that time? Bloated. Unrecognizable. He had seen bodies like that before. They would have to run DNA, but even then. Will's brain would always battle over whether or not that swollen, discolored face belonged to his wife, or if Angie had managed to cheat death the way she always cheated everything else. She was a survivor. She could still be out there. Collier was right. Angie always had a guy. Maybe one of those guys was a doctor. Maybe she was recovering right now. Too frail to pick up the phone and let Will know that she was alive. Not that she would ever call him so long as Sarah was around. Will pressed his fingers into his eyes. The elevator stopped on the 29th floor. The door slid open. White marble gleamed from every surface. A gorgeous, model-thin blonde looked up from her computer at the reception counter. Will recognized her from before, but he was certain she would not remember him. He was wrong. Agent Trent. Her smile dropped into a straight line. Take a seat. Mr. Kilpatrick is still in his meeting. He'll be 5 or 10 minutes. Kip Kilpatrick was smart, but he wasn't clairvoyant. Last Will had heard, Amanda was meeting with Marcus Rippey's agent, lawyer, the first thing tomorrow morning. Up until half an hour ago, even Will didn't know he was going to be here. Or maybe Kilpatrick wasn't expecting Will to show up so much as waiting for him to. It made sense. Marcus Rippey was Kilpatrick's biggest client, his only can of Coke. The slimy agent had already scuttled a rape charge. Explaining away a dead body was a comparative cakewalk. There, the woman pointed to a seating area. Will followed her order, walking across the lobby, which was the same square footage of his entire house. There was a frosted glass door that led to the offices, and one that led to a bathroom. But other than that, the lobby was completely closed off from the rest of the business. From the sparse decor, you'd never know that you were standing right outside one of the top sports agencies in the country.
Will supposed that was by design. No prospective client wanted to sit in the lobby staring at the smiling face of his on-court rival. Conversely, if your star was fading, you didn't want to see some hot young Turk's picture had taken your place on the wall. Will sank into one of the comfortable chairs beside an expanse of floor-to-ceiling windows. Everything in the lobby was chrome and dark blue leather. The view outside stretched all the way to downtown. The light gray walls had 110% printed over and over again in a glossy, clear varnish like wallpaper. There was a sign that hadn't been here the last time. Giant, gold-leafed letters mounted on what looked like a nickel-plated quarter-inch sheet of metal that was taller than Will. Will studied the letters. There were three lines of text, each at least 18 inches tall. He watched the letters float around like sea anemones. An M crossed with an A. An E morphed into a Y. Will had always had trouble reading. He wasn't illiterate. He could read, but it took some time, and it helped if the words were printed or neatly written. The problem had plagued him since childhood. He'd barely graduated high school. Most of his teachers assumed he was just lazy or stupid or both. Will was in college when a professor mentioned dyslexia. It was a diagnosis he did not share with anyone else because people assumed that slow reading meant you had a slow mind. Sarah was the first person Will had ever met who didn't treat his disability like a handicap. Man, age, meant. Will silently read the three words from the sign a second, then a third time. He heard the sound of a toilet flushing, then a faucet running, then an air hand dryer. The bathroom door opened. An older, well-dressed African-American woman came out. She leaned heavily on a cane as she walked toward the seating area. The receptionist turned on a smile. "Laszlo will come for you in another minute, Mrs. Lindsay." Will stood up because he had been raised by a woman old enough to be his grandmother, and Mrs. Flanagan had taught them manners more suited to the greatest generation. Mrs. Lindsay seemed to appreciate the gesture. She smiled sweetly as she sat down on the couch opposite Will. She asked, "Is it still hot as the dickens outside?" He took a seat. "Yes, ma'am." "Lord help us." She smiled at him again, then picked up a magazine. Sports Illustrated. Marcus Rippey was on the cover, palming a basketball. Will looked out the window because seeing the man's face made him want to throw his chair across the room. Mrs. Lindsay tore out a subscription card and started to fan herself. Will crossed his leg over his knee. He sat back in the deep chair. His calf was throbbing. There was a dot of blood on the leg of his jeans. He felt like a lifetime had passed since his foot had broken through the rotted floor of the condemned office building. At home, he'd wrapped his bleeding calf in gauze, but apparently that hadn't solved the problem. He looked at his watch. He ignored the dried blood on the back of his hand. He checked his phone, which was packed with threats from Amanda. The only sound in the room was Mrs. Lindsay turning an occasional page in her magazine and the sporadic clattering of the receptionist's long fingernails hitting her keyboard. Tap, tap, tap. She was far from proficient. Will couldn't stop himself from duplicating the mantra from the elevator. "Angie, Angie, Angie." She disappeared all the time. Months would go by, sometimes an entire year, and then one day Will would be eating dinner over the kitchen sink or lying on the couch watching TV, and Angie would let herself into the house and act like only a few minutes had passed since the last time she'd seen him. She would always say, "It's me, baby. Did you miss me?" That's what she was doing now. She had disappeared, and she would be back because she always came back eventually. Will uncrossed his legs. He leaned forward, hands clasped between his knees. He twisted the cheap wedding ring around his finger. He'd bought the gold band for $25 at a pawn shop. He had wanted to look legitimately married for the bank manager. Will could have saved the cash. The manager had barely glanced at his ID,
before giving him access to Angie's entire financial life. He picked at the ring. The gold was chipping off. It was nicer than the one Angie had given him. Will dropped his hands. He wanted to stand up and pace, but he felt instinctively that the receptionist would not like that. Neither, he imagined, would Mrs. Lindsay. Nothing was worse than watching someone else pace back and forth, plus it was a giant tip-off that you were nervous about something. And he didn't want Kip Kilpatrick to know that he was nervous. Should he be nervous? Will had the upper hand. At least he thought he did. But Kilpatrick had blindsided him before. Will picked up a magazine. He recognized the Rob Report logo. There was a Bentley Bentayga SUV on the cover. Will paged to the article. Numbers had never been a problem for him. He found the car's specs and traced his finger under the text. The words were easier to make out because they were familiar from other specs in other magazines, because he loved cars. Twin-turbo 6-liter W12, 600 horsepower, and 664 pounds per foot of torque. Top speed of 187 miles per hour. The interior photographs showed hand-embroidered leather seats and delicate reading around the chrome gauges. Will drove a 37-year-old Porsche 911, but the car was no classic. His first mode of transportation had been a Kawasaki dirt bike, a sweet ride if you could show up for work covered in sweat or soaked in rain. One day, Will had spotted a burned-out chassis abandoned in a field near his house. He'd paid some homeless guys to help him carry what was left of the Porsche back to his garage. The car was drivable after 6 months, but lack of money and a daunting technical schematic meant that it took Will almost 10 years to fully restore it. Sarah had taken him to test drive a brand-new 911 at Christmas. The trip to the dealership had been a surprise. Will had felt like an imposter, standing in the showroom, but Sarah had been right at home. She was used to being around money. Her apartment was a penthouse loft that cost north of $1 million. Her BMW X5 had every bell and whistle. Sarah had that confidence that came from knowing she could afford to buy what she wanted. Like the way she had stood in those open houses yesterday, looking around the large, open spaces, silently thinking about the things she would change to make it more suited for her tastes, completely missing the fact that Will's hands were shaking as he held the flyer and counted the number of zeros in front of the decimal. Will's social security number had been stolen by a foster parent when he was 6 years old. He didn't find this out until he was 20 and tried to open his first bank account. His credit was in the toilet. He'd had to pay cash for everything until he was 28, and then the only credit card he could use was the one attached to his ATM. Even his house had been paid for with cash. He'd bought it at a tax foreclosure auction on the courthouse steps. For the first 3 years, he'd slept with a shotgun beside his bed because crack addicts kept showing up expecting to score some rocks from the gang that used to squat there. Will still couldn't get a credit card. Because of his cash-only policy, he had gone from bad credit to no credit. He literally did not show up with any of the ratings agencies. If Sarah thought they were going to be able to buy a house together, she'd better be prepared to exchange her million-dollar penthouse loft for a shoebox. After ignoring Amanda all day, Will probably didn't have a job anymore. "Are you a ball player?" Will looked up from the magazine. Mrs. Lindsay was talking to him. "No, ma'am," he told her. And then because, as far as he knew, it was still technically true, he said, "I'm a special agent with the Georgia Bureau of Investigation." "Isn't that interesting?" She played with the pearls around her neck. "Now, the GBI is the state police?" "No, ma'am. We're a statewide agency that provides assistance with criminal investigations, forensic laboratory services, and computerized criminal justice information."
"Sort of like the FBI, but to the state?"
She had picked it up quicker than most.
"Yes, ma'am, exactly."
"All kinds of cases?"
"Yes, ma'am, every kind."
"How interesting."
She started to rummage inside her purse.
"Are you here for your job,
I hope no one is in trouble.
Will shook his head.
No, ma'am, just some routine questions.
What's your full name?
Will Trent.
Will Trent. A man with two first names.
She took out a small notebook with a church glass pattern on the vinyl cover. She picked at the pen inside the spiral.
Will leaned up so he could get his wallet. He fished out one of his business cards.
This is me.
She studied the card. Will Trent, Special Agent, Georgia Bureau of Investigation.
She smiled at him as she tucked the card into her notebook and returned it to her purse.
I like to remember people I meet. How long have you been married?
Will glanced down at the pawn shop ring on his finger.
Was he a widower?
What did you call yourself if your wife died when you no longer wanted to be married to her?
I'm sorry, Mrs. Lindsay apologized. I'm being nosy. My daughter is always telling me I'm too curious for my own good.
No, ma'am, that's all right. I'm kind of nosy, too.
I should hope so, considering your job.
She laughed, so Will laughed, too. She told him,
I was married for 51 years to a wonderful man.
You were a child bride.
She laughed again. You're very kind, Special Agent Trent, but no.
My husband passed away 3 years ago.
Will felt a lump come into his throat.
And you have a daughter?
Yes.
That was all she said. She clutched her purse in her lap. She kept smiling at him. He smiled back. And then he saw her bottom lip start to quiver. Her eyes were moist.
Will glanced at the receptionist, who was still typing on her computer.
He lowered his voice.
Is everything all right?
Oh, yes.
Her teeth showed in a wide smile, but the lip would not stop its tremble.
Everything is wonderful.
Will noticed that the receptionist had stopped typing. She had the phone to her ear. Mrs. Lindsay's lip had not stopped quivering. She was obviously upset about something. He tried to sound conversational.
Do you live around here?
Just up the street.
Buckhead, Will said. My boss lives down the road in those townhomes near Peachtree Battle.
That's a nice area. I'm in the older building at the curve across from the churches.
Jesus Junction, Will supplied.
The Lord is everywhere.
Will wasn't religious, but he said,
It's good to have somebody looking out for you.
You're so right. I am truly blessed.
Will felt like he was trapped inside a plasma globe with little sparks of electricity arcing back and forth between him and Mrs. Lindsay. They kept staring at each other for at least another 10 seconds before the door behind the receptionist's desk opened.
Miss Lindsay?
A bullet-headed thug wearing a tight-fitting black shirt and even tighter black pants stood in the open doorway. His Boston accent was as thick as his neck.
Let's bring you back, sweetheart.
Miss Lindsay gripped her cane and stood, so Will stood too.
It was nice meeting you.
You too.
She offered her hand. He shook it. Her skin was clammy. She bit her lip to stop the tremble. She leaned on her cane to get herself started, then walked through the open door without turning back around. The thug eyeballed Will a fuck you before shutting the door behind him. Will took a wild shot in the dark and guessed this was Laszlo, and that Laszlo worked for Kip Kilpatrick. Behind every fixer was a sleazeball eager to get his hands dirty. Laszlo struck Will as the type who came pre-dirtied. The receptionist said, Mr. Kilpatrick should be about 5 or 10 minutes.
More.
She looked confused. So Will explained,
Because you said 5 to 10 minutes before, so now it's...
She started pecking on her computer again. Will stuck his hands into his pockets. He looked at the couch, feeling like Mrs. Lindsay might have left something for him. A breadcrumb, maybe. Nothing. He walked toward the bathroom door, turned around, and walked back toward the drink sign. He'd been right about the pacing. The receptionist kept giving him annoyed looks as she picked away at her computer keyboard.
He wondered if she was updating her Facebook page. What exactly was required of a receptionist if she wasn't in charge of answering phones? Will considered this as he paced, because the other things he had to consider were too much to bear. He was on his sixth revolution when a loud ding pierced the air. The elevator doors slid open. Amanda stepped out. Her expression quickly changed from surprise to fury to her usual mask of indifference. "You're early," she said, as if the fact that he was standing in the lobby hadn't shocked the hell out of her. She turned to the receptionist. "Can you find out how much longer Mr. Kilpatrick will be?" The girl picked up the phone. Her fingernails spiked the keypad. "Thank you." Amanda's tone was polite, but her shoes gave her away. The heels stabbed into the marble floor like knives. She sat in the chair Will had abandoned. Her feet didn't reach the ground. She teetered a bit as she tried to keep her balance. Will had never seen Amanda sit all the way back in a chair, but the problem was that this particular chair had been built for someone with a basketball player's long legs. No wonder Will had been so comfortable. He told her, "Sorry I was early." She picked up the Rob report. "I think I prefer you without testicles." The receptionist hung up the phone with a clatter. "Mr. Kilpatrick said he'll be 5 or 10 minutes. For Will's sake," she added, "more." "Thank you." Amanda stared at the magazine with a sudden interest in luxury watches. Will figured he couldn't piss off Amanda any more than he already had. He resumed his pacing back and forth between the bathroom and the sign. He thought about the second envelope he had found in Angie's post office box. White, nondescript, more shocking than the first. There was no stamp. Angie had left it for him, and Will had left it locked inside his car. The Kilpatrick envelope was evidence. The second was nobody's business. He asked Amanda, "Did you find anything?" She stared at him blankly. "At the crime scene." Amanda turned to the receptionist. "Excuse me?" She waited for the girl to look up. "The last time I was here, I was served a lovely mint tea. Do you mind making some for me again? With honey?" The receptionist forced a smile. She slammed her hands on the desk and rolled back her chair so she could stand. She opened the door to the offices and closed it hard behind her. Amanda told Will, "Sit down." He sat on the couch. She said, "You've got until the girl comes back to explain to me why I shouldn't fire you on the spot." Will couldn't think of a good reason, so he settled on coming clean. He pulled the 110 envelope out of his back pocket. He tossed it onto the glass coffee table. Amanda didn't touch it. She read the return address, which was for the office they were sitting in. Like the wallpaper in the lobby, the 110% was repeated in clear ink across the front and back. Instead of asking what was inside the envelope, she said, "How did you get Angie's P.O. box number?" "I went to the bank. I'm on her checking account. The P.O. box is inside a UPS store off Spring Street." She gave him a withering look. "Your phone belongs to the GBI, Will. I could track you to the bathroom if I wanted to." She motioned for him to continue. "So you went to the store and..." Will let the information about the tracking sink in. "I showed the manager the bank statement with our names on it and my driver's license, and he gave me access to the post office box." He left out the $100 cash that had exchanged hands, and the veiled threats that he had made to the store owner about the GBI's fraud investigation division, but something about the look Amanda gave him said that she knew. She studied the envelope again, still not touching it.
"Who did you hit?"
He looked at the broken skin on the back of his hand.
"Somebody who probably didn't deserve it. Are they going to be a problem?"
Will didn't think Collier was the type.
"No. You need to take off that wedding ring before you see Sarah. And I wouldn't tell her you're still listed on Angie's bank account, because she might wonder how you can find that post office box in 2 hours when you haven't been able to find one single viable lead off Angie in the last year and a half."
Will didn't hear a question, so He didn't give an answer.
Why are you still on her account?
Because she needs money sometimes. He looked out the window. The truth was, he didn't know why he hadn't tried to track down Angie through the bank statement before.
She'll text me sometimes that she needs help. Which means you have her phone number? The last time she texted me was 13 months ago for a couple $100s.
It was actually 500, but Will didn't want to overshare.
The phone number that Charlie found is the same number she texted from. It's been disconnected, he added. And it's the same number on her bank account.
Amanda finally picked up the envelope. She pulled out the $5,000 check written from Kip Kilpatrick's personal account. Proof that Angie had been working for Kilpatrick. Amanda let her hand fall to her lap.
This is why she didn't need to borrow money. If you can call it borrowing. I'm assuming she never paid you back.
Again, he did not answer the question that was not asked.
For the last 3 months, Angie has shown a $5,000 deposit every 2 weeks, the same amount that's on that check. She was working for Kip Kilpatrick. For what reason do you think Kilpatrick was paying her $10,000 a month out of his private account?
Will shrugged, but he could think of a lot of illicit things Angie would do. She'd had a pill problem on and off from childhood. She didn't mind doing bad things or looking the other way when people did bad things for her. She had also dipped into legal enterprises, so Will went with the least of her sins.
She was registered with the state as a private investigator. Maybe Kilpatrick had her investigating people, doing background checks on potential clients. She worked security part-time when she was a cop. Maybe she did that for him, too.
He asked her again,
"What did you find at the crime scene?"
Amanda ignored the question a second time.
"Tell me the reason you didn't call me half an hour ago when you found this check."
Will looked down at his hands. He was twisting the wedding ring again. He didn't know why he had developed an attachment to it. The ring meant about as much as the one that Angie had put on his finger at the courthouse.
Amanda said, "The blood in the room is type B negative, which is a very rare blood type. Angie is type B negative. That's all I have for you."
All the blood was B negative?
The majority of the blood, yes. The volume.
Will heard Sarah's words echo in his head. The volume of blood loss is the real danger.
Amanda said, "Jane Doe is still in surgery. We have a lead on a gal named Delilah Palmer. Ever heard of her?"
Will shook his head.
"White female, 22 years old. Her sheet has prostitution and drugs times 8. Harding was her guardian angel. She's been on the game for a while."
"Angie worked vice when she was a cop."
"Did she really?"
Amanda put on a bad show of sounding surprised.
"We've put out a high alert. This Delilah Palmer likely knows why Dale and Angie were killed, which either makes her our top suspect or our next victim."
Will twisted the ring on his finger. He forced himself not to look at his watch, to do the math for how much time had passed since Sarah had said that Angie didn't have much time. She would come back. Angie always came back. That's how he would get through this. He would treat this time like every other time she disappeared. And a year would go by, 2 years, and Will would find a way to accept that he had watched Amanda pretend to read a magazine while Angie had died alone. Just like she always said she would do. Just like Will had wished she would do because he wanted things to be easier with Sarah. He looked out the window. He tried to swallow. He felt that familiar tightness in his chest. The last thing he had said to Angie was that he didn't love her anymore. Then he had gone back to Sarah. Amanda put down her magazine. She stood up. She walked around the coffee table and sat on the edge of the couch. She smoothed out her skirt. She stared at the wall in front of her. Her shoulder touched his, and it took everything Will had inside of him not to lean against her. She said,
"You know, my mother hanged herself in our backyard when I was a child."
Will looked up. She had spoken,
matter-of-factly, but the truth was that he hadn't known.
She said, "Every time I wash dishes, I would look out the window at that tree and think, you are the last person who is ever going to make me feel this way ever again."
Will didn't ask which way she meant.
"And then Kenny came along. I'm sure Faith has told you about her uncle."
Will nodded. Kenny Mitchell was a retired pilot who'd flown test engines for NASA.
"Kenny was a stone-cold fox, as we used to say."
She smiled her secret smile.
"I couldn't understand why he chose me. I was such a plain, silly girl. Very naive. Desperate to please my father. Wouldn't say boo to a ghost."
Will couldn't picture Amanda being any of those things.
"Kenny was like a drug. At first in the exciting way, then in the bad way. The way that led your Jane Doe to vacuuming up 2 ounces of coke."
Amanda's tone said she wasn't exaggerating.
"I lowered myself for him. I did things that I never thought I would ever, ever do."
Will glanced back toward the closed office door. How long did water take to boil for tea?
Amanda said, "The hardest part was that deep down inside, I knew it. I knew he would never marry me. I knew he would never give me children."
She paused.
"I could spot a lying perp from 50 yards, but I chose to believe everything that came out of Kenny's mouth. I'd invested so many years of my life in him that I couldn't admit that I was wrong. I was terrified of looking like a fool."
Will sat back on the couch. If she thought that was how he was with Angie, then she was wrong. Will knew from the beginning that Angie was the wrong person for him. As for looking like a fool, everybody knew that she cheated on him. Used to cheat on him. Amanda continued,
"Kenny and I had been together for nearly 8 years when I met Roger."
Her voice softened when she said the name.
"I'll spare you the details, but let's just say he caught my eye. He wanted to give me everything I didn't have with Kenny, but I said no, because I didn't know how to be with a man who wanted to be with me."
The softness had drained away.
"I was addicted to Kenny's uncertainty, that niggling little doubt in my gut that made me wonder if I could survive without him. I thought I could fix the pain inside of him. It took me a long time to realize that the pain was inside of me."
Will rubbed his jaw. That hit a little closer to home. Amanda turned toward him, her hand resting on the back of the couch.
"We had this kitten when I was a little girl. Buttons. She kept clawing the couch, so my father bought me a water pistol and told me to shoot her every time she got near it. And I remember that first time I squirted her. She panicked and ran to me for comfort. She clung to me and I petted her until she calmed down. That's how I was with Kenny. That's how you were with Angie."
Amanda said this with conviction.
"It's the curse of the motherless child. We seek comfort from the very people who do us harm."
Her words splayed him open like a razor.
She said, "I think you never checked Angie's bank statement because you were afraid that she'd closed the account, that she'd cut off that final tie with you."
Will looked down at his hands, the broken skin from punching Collier, the fake ring that signified his fake marriage.
"Am I right?"
He shrugged, but he knew that she was right. Angie had left him a letter. That was what was inside the second envelope inside her post office box. This one had Will's name written on the outside in all capital letters, clear so that he could easily read it. The letter inside was a different matter. Angie had deliberately written him a note in her cursive chicken scratch because she knew that Will would not be able to read it. He would have to find someone else to read it for him.
"Sarah?"
He cleared his throat.
"What made you finally leave Kenny?" You think I'd ever give up?
She laughed deep from her belly.
Oh, no. Kenny left me. For a man.